Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of The Grueling Truth. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and as always, I want to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage. How you doing tonight, Matt?
Doing real good, Mike. Good to have you back. Hope you had a good vacation.
Yeah, and I listened to you and Dexter Carter last week on the first 49ers the first show for our 49ers show, and I was entertained during my vacation with that for a little while.
Good deal.
So tonight we got a very special guest, one of the top running backs of the decade of the 1980s, 10 years, and he ran for over 8,000 yards, 69 touchdowns, Super Bowl 26 champion, three-time Pro Bowler. Help me welcome to the Grueling Truth, former Atlanta Falcons and Washington Redskin running back, Gerald Riggs.
How you doing, guys?
All right. It's good
Real
to have
good.
You on the show.
Glad to have you.
Well, glad to be a part of it.
Well, let's just start off with your younger years. Just tell us a little bit about when you were younger, when you started playing football, if you had any major influences when you started playing, whether it be high school, peewee, or whatever. Just tell us a little bit about what got you started playing football.
Trouble. Just being in a lot of trouble. I needed something to get this wild little crazy little kid off the streets. And, I don't have that from the carrying a football from the crib type of, lifestyle that I grew up with in Las Vegas, Nevada. I was a kid that, I did a lot of other things, played basketball, ran track, and, I loved other things to do, but football was kind of that one sport that I didn't quite like. I didn't like being hit on or punched on or tackled and all that sort of stuff. And I pretty much avoided it. I had issues with anger. I had temperamental problems. I was a kid that didn't grow up with a father, first of all. And my mother did everything she could to try to make sure that, she at least gave me something to keep me busy. But football was not one that I took to in the beginning. I did try to play when I was in sixth grade. And the first time I went out, I got tackled and a kid knocked me over the bag and I got up and started fighting. And, the coach was like, picked me up. He was a big, strong guy. I'll never forget him. He picked me up by the back of my pants, my belt, and he's holding me up. And he's asking me why to fight the kid. Why was I punching him? I'm like, coach, he hit me. He's like, he just tackled you. I'm like, well, that was hitting to me. So I didn't want no parts of it and stopped playing football. And didn't actually, I really almost missed my blessing, guys, because of my good friends. Who I grew up with, they all played football. They played on the little peewee teams, and I didn't play that peewee ball and all that, but I played all the way up until high school, and I had a little stint with my sophomore year and new school. To make a long story short, didn't get along with the coach and whatnot, and almost missed my blessing that I ended up going back out my senior year and had, at that point in time in my life, kind of recommitting my life to maybe being a little bit different after having some advice from a school advisor, an academic advisor, at the school athletic director, talked me into staying out on the team because I was clearly my athletic ability was kind of off the chain or whatever, and they were like, why don't you just give this a try? And I did, and I stuck it out and got a scholarship offer, and the rest was history.
Well, Gerald, what made you, after high school, what made you want to decide to go to Arizona State?
Well, growing up in out west, it was the Pacific 8 or the WAC Conference. That's all we got in football. Once in a while, we would get some games from back east to Texas and maybe some of the Notre Dame games and all that sort of stuff. But the WAC Conference was pretty prevalent where I was living in Las Vegas. We'd get a lot of their games, and for whatever reason, I loved watching Arizona State play. It wasn't about the Frank Kush, whatever. I used to always think that little helmet was pretty neat with the little sun devil on the side of it. and that kind of attracted me. And then that one year that I played in high school, someone put the word out that, hey, you guys need to come and see this guy here in Las Vegas who's, you know, this big running back who's kind of tearing it up. And once they came a call, it was pretty much a done deal. You know, John Robinson was at USC, had you know, went to visit, and oddly enough, me and Marcus Allen, I know you guys have talked to him before, and, you know, we were there on a recruiting trip at the same time. And it was just not to be where I was going to be in the backfield with Marcus Allen. I'd rather have been at Arizona State at the time.
Well, you went to Arizona State, and I know I've talked to some guys that played for Coach Kush. What was your opinion of Coach Kush, and do you have any good, you know, stories about Coach Frank Kush?
I loved him. He was tough, but I loved Frank Kush. I think I was probably the only running back he never probably punched. That's the only thing I can remember, bro.
That's some of the stories I heard, too, by the way.
He would. There were some guys that he made rag dolls out of, but most of them deserved it. And for all of what you heard about him and how disciplined he was and how tough he was on the players and whatnot, we absolutely loved him. Very few guys that I can really point out, with the exception of the guy that probably helped get him out of there. We all felt a warm place in our heart for Frank Kush and what he had done for us as a coach. He helped us. He was unlike most of these coaches nowadays, where he was the father figure. Most coaches now is like, you know, they're that figurehead of the school more so than they are of the men that they represent. Yes, they coach and they have these rules and all those things are in place, but Frank was literally a father figure to a lot of kids, especially one like me who didn't grow up with a dad. He was that guy that helped me understand the discipline that I needed, the things that I needed to do to be a better man in school, on and off the field, in the community, all about. So, but he was tough. He was tough. Many stories of things when I was going to school there. The first thing was the offensive lineman that I always I loved him when he got involved with the offensive lineman. He used to walk around with his long stick all the time, and he would kind of say something to the offensive lineman. He was only about 5'4". So when you go in and talking to a guy who's 6'5", 6'6", or whatever, he's looking up at him all the time. But as soon as Frank walked up to the offensive lineman, he wanted to get their attention. The guy may be standing there with, it's hot, he's tired, he's mad, and here comes Frank Kush, getting on him about something. And Frank would take that stick and stand in front of him, and he'd say a couple of words, and if the guy didn't look down at him, he'd wrap him in the shins, and the guy would come down to his face level. So Frank was like, okay, now I've got your attention now. He would do so many different things, hitting you in the head with a whistle, your helmet. And that, if you had a helmet on, you hear that whistle hit you in the head, the ring would drive you nuts. But either way, a lot of stories I could probably share with you guys, but for, the interest of time, I'll hold it to another time.
Well, 1982, you get drafted by the Atlanta Falcons.
Yes.
And, very unusual year to get drafted in the NFL. All of a sudden, a couple games into the season, we got a player's strike.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you as a rookie, and were you for it or against it one way or another?
Wow, that was, you bring back something there. I did not like that at all. I was not very up on what the issues were at the time. It was more or less, and I don't think the large amount of the guys who came in the league that year were not, they didn't, it was like, listen, we just want to play. We want to earn a paycheck and we want to get on the field. And the veteran guys were, they were all trying to get all these guys to say, well, hey, now you're part of the NFL, you're part of the union, you're part of this and that. And I was one of those guys that I never, took to, if I didn't understand it, I wasn't going to be about it. I wasn't going to be behind it. And I was one of the few guys that when they go out and did the solidarity handshake, I didn't go out. I sat on the bench because I didn't understand what it was all about, and nobody really made it clear to me. And I just didn't do it. And, after a few weeks had gone by, and after I talked to, a couple of guys with it, whatever, then when we all came back, then, yeah, I had a lot more understanding of what it was all about. But in the beginning, that was a pretty rocky way to start my NFL career, but nonetheless, it got behind us, and the NFL said at the time that they would go broke paying a lot of these guys. I don't think they're broke at all.
No. All right, when you got to the Falcons, I mean, they already had a couple really good running backs. You had William Andrews, Lynn Cain. I mean, your rookie season, did anybody kind of take you under their wing to kind of teach you the ropes or help you out?
Well, you know what, oddly enough, it didn't come from the running back. Me and William, we're very dear friends now. But in the beginning, no, that didn't start out that way. The guy who really actually kind of took me under his wing was the center, Jeff Van Note. He was a guy who, kind of pulled me aside and would talk to me about certain things and tried to help me understand how, just understand what we do as a lineman. As linemen, we will, we'll do some of those things. And I love to listen to linemen because they are some of the smartest guys out there on the field. You know, I don't think that it's a secret with some of that now, but they usually are some of the most some of the smartest guys out there. And Jeff Van Note was the first one who really kind of warmed up to me, being that everybody thought that, well, hey, with William Andrews and Lynn Cain there, that they didn't really need a running back at the time. And, it was about business. It's about the future. It's about trying to, make sure that you have the guy who's going to, if something happens, which unfortunately it did, but there was somebody else to step in and do the job, and I was, the next guy up, next man up, and I made good on it.
Now, I'm going to bring this up before Mike does. 1983 comes around. Now, I'm a 49er fan, and, your kind of calling out party, from what I can remember from that year, was that game in Atlanta, the Hail Mary game, and I remember you running off like a 40 or 45 yard run, and then Billy White Shoes Johnson came down with the Hail Mary. What was it like to if you can share any thoughts from that game and what it was like to play with a guy like Billy White Shoes Johnson?
Oh man, it was absolutely great to play with Billy. He was one of the probably one of the guys on the team that, first of all, he was a team joker. He's one of the funniest guys around. You just won't believe just how hilarious he can be on a daily. I mean, you come in a locker room and it's like you walk by his locker and he's got this little sinister grin all the time, knowing it's like he's up to something. You just know he was, and we always just clowned around all the time. He was one of the funniest guys out there on the field, but when he'd go out there and play, I tell you what, he was one of the most courageous guys out there on the field, too. Awful a bunch of courage to do what he did as a punt returner, and basically fearless. And I don't know if he was running out of fear or whatever, but he was pretty darn good at running back punts and that sort of thing, and being out there on the field all the time. But I remember that play so well, in that I Steve was in the game, and we called a play, and I said, Steve, if nobody really rushes, I'm going down the field. And Steve was like, just hey, if you have to, get down there as quick as you can, because I'm throwing this and I'm laying it out. And sure enough, if you see on the film, when Billy catches the ball, I am almost there. I'm thinking I'm going to try to drag him in the end zone or whatever, but he still gets in and makes the play, one of the biggest plays in Falcon history. And it just to be on the field with Billy Johnson doing it, which we still talk today, he's just a very, very dear friend and one of the greatest players in the NFL history.
Yeah, I would just like to thank you for that game, because I'm a Cincinnati Bengals fan and the 49ers beat us the
really?
Twice. And 49ers
really?
Fans
this
just
is why
arrogant
I brought it
as hell. And all I got to hear about all the time are all these championships and everything, and he always makes fun of my team. I just wish I would have known Matt at that point, even though he'd have been like 2 years old, just so I could have made fun of him about it.
Not quite.
Well,
okay.
I couldn't stand any of those teams anyway. I mean, we had to play them in that old NFC West division, and we had to play them twice a year. And I tell you what, between Montana and all those guys that they had, the defense they had, Bill Walsh and all, I mean, like it was one of those, I guess we had probably some of the most bitter rivalries and out of all the conferences. I mean, you got the NFC East, and then you talk about them, and you got the North Division. They had all that stuff in there, but us and New Orleans and San Francisco and the Rams, gosh, we hated those teams.
Okay, 1984, I think your first start was week one, wasn't it? and you ran for like 2 or 3 touchdowns, 200 yards. I think you guys beat the Saints like 35-28.
Yes,
tell us a little bit about
that.
One
of those times where, well, like I say, it was next man up. And I think, that was the first time that I had the opportunity to kind of take the lead with Dan Henning and that one back offense, certainly one that I'd have to say was totally, you know, that was the offense that kind of put me on the map. And it was the ideal formation for me. I was a blocking fullback coming out of college, and but I'd been a tailback for a little short time in high school, and I at least had the opportunity to do both. So being able to get in that one back offense was something that was it was huge for me, and being able to have that offense out there at the time with like I say, with Dan Henning, who came in there and brought that system, the old Joe Gibbs with Washington system, which is it was great. And New Orleans was the first team that I actually had a chance, actually the year before, really. I think they had an opportunity to kind of get a few games underneath my belt with them, and I was returning kickoffs and all that. And I didn't know where it was going to go, being that William was there, but he had gotten hurt going into that year, prior to that year, and I was just ready to step up and make the and take on the challenge. And hey, like I say, rest was history.
So yeah, when William Anderson, during that off season, was Andrews already hurt, or were you battling it out with him in training camp?
Well, he got hurt in training camp.
He got hurt in training camp.
Yeah, he got hurt in training camp, and so that's kind of, you know, when that happens, you know, you get a chance to get the reps and get ready for it. And he had gotten hurt in, I want to say the year before. That was 84, was that 83? My mind goes in and out, guy, but I thought it was 83. But either way, he was hurt, and of course was the next guy up, Dan Henning. I remember him telling me that he didn't know much about me, basically coming in there. But after what he had saw in training camp and whatever, he wanted me to push William as much as I could, because he was a starter, but Dan felt that the offense was more suited for me. So,
all right, 1985, you came in second place for the rushing title behind Marcus Allen. 9 games,
yeah.
You ran for over 100 yards, I believe. Another 3 games over 90. Most of the time, players say they don't look at stats and they're only focused on winning.
Yeah.
I believe that most of the time that's true. But was there any checking at all in checking Marcus's numbers that year?
No. I heard it. As a matter of fact, strange thing. I can't remember who was doing it. They played it was on Monday night when I guess going into that last game of the year, and I was ahead of Marcus. And they played on Monday night, I believe. Monday night football.
They played the Rams. I remember watching that game.
I think so. I think they played a Monday night game, and it was at that particular time, I was like,
all right, it looks like Gerald Riggs has dropped a call.
Uh-oh.
Matt, you got anything to add?
Well, boy, that's kind of abrupt, but yeah, thanks for saying that. How did you phrase it? Arrogant fans? Wow.
Yeah, well, arrogant fans. And he said he didn't like the 49ers either.
Well, so. I wouldn't expect him to. He's a Falcon. But
well, no, he
did,
has a brain, but.
But he, I liked all that stuff about White Shoes Johnson. Just looking at the guy, always happy. You totally can believe that he's a jokester in the locker room and all that good stuff.
And he's one of the best kickers in NFL history.
For sure. The guy, wasn't he making a comeback? By that time,
there
got
we
him
go. Gerald's
hurt.
Back on the line. You there, Gerald?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm here. Actually, I'm here. But
all right.
I was just about to make this point about the fact how the world didn't know that I was actually behind or ahead of Marcus at the time. I want to say it was whoever was doing the Monday night football game, I mean, Frank Gifford and somebody, whatever, they were saying, I think, when Marcus finally had broken or gotten the lead in that particular game, the guys, I'll never forget that they said that Marcus finally takes the lead over Walter Payton. And I was like, wow. Talk about no respect. I'm like, wow, these guys are here doing Monday night football. So at that time, I was really kind of that was the first time I really kind of looked at this, the numbers and really kind of paid attention to it because I was I think they were giving Marcus the ball when he came off the bus. He was over, I think he was over 100 yards or so behind me, and he ended up getting the rushing title that year. And you know, but hey, I respect Marcus. He was he was a great running back, certainly even at SC. We've had many battles over the years, and but yeah, he beat me out that year.
1986, you had another really good season, and then 87 and 88, it looks a couple of injuries. But then you get a change of scenery. You go over to Washington in 1989, and by week two, you have your career game in one of the best offensive shootouts that I can remember, the big 42-37 game, Washington-Philadelphia. As that's your career game and you have a lot of long runs, tell us about what that was like for you, especially, you know, going over to new scenery.
Well, you know what? That was one of those things that it'll be in my book that I didn't see coming. First of all, you know, Marin Campbell came into the Falcons and decided that they needed to do things to move forward, and decided to trade me at the time, and I didn't know about the trade at all until, bless his heart, Whitey Zimmerman, who was the team trainer who usually took the card up to, at the draft day, on draft day, walked up there, and about 30 seconds before he got there, that's when I received a call and said I was going to be traded. So I was like, wow, this was happening right in front of my face, but it happened. I was glad to be there. Joe Gibbs, again, the system was ideal for me. They brought Ernest Biner along with me, and that was the beginning of what I thought was a pretty doggone good relationship and a pretty good backfield, and certainly what they did and the way Joe Gibbs went about doing it. I think that team was built for a Super Bowl run in a very, very short period of time, and we did.
Well, you played for a great coach in Joe Gibbs there. Do you have anything, or what was your opinion of Joe Gibbs? What was it like to play for him?
Loved it. I tell you what, it was one of the best things about Joe Gibbs and his staff was watching those guys at halftime. When it came down to making adjustments, when it came down to putting things in or taking things out that we had done or had done in previous games or whatnot, there was no such thing as a lot of players. I think if you're playing in the NFL, there's no dumb players, but you certainly had to know your stuff playing with Joe Gibbs and how intricate his system was. We would do some. He was pretty remarkable when it came to halftime adjustments, and that's what I loved watching about it more. It was halftime. Okay, what were we going to do? It was almost kind of like you're excited to go in and see. Okay, hey, some things didn't work, but let's go in and see what we can do and try to change some things around. We come out and we pretty much dominated that year going into the Super Bowl.
All right, real quick, let me remind listeners, the first half hour of our show is live. When we get to the bottom of the hour, we'll still have archived time at 15 minutes with Gerald Riggs. At the top of the hour, you can go to the Blog Talk Radio Network or the Grueling Truth Facebook page and get the podcast and hear the last 15 minutes of the interview with the first 30. Matt?
So you also played on another one of my favorite offenses with the Posse and Mark Rippon, the early 90s. What was it like to play with those guys?
I'll tell you what, you talk about some real pros, and I'm talking about Gary Clark, Art Monk, Ricky Sanders, Those guys were fearless. They were just fearless. They wanted the best that you had out there, and they were not going to back down. It was like Joe couldn't go out there and say, I mean, it would drive Joe crazy because he would be concerned and worried about, you know, different teams like the Giants with Lawrence Taylor or something, or some of the other teams with, you know, with guys who are, you know, caused a lot of problems. But Gary Clark and those guys and Art Monk, they would go out and they were just absolutely fearless. It was like, okay, let's put the best defense back, whoever it is, put them out there on whoever. And they were, you know, let's do what we have to do. They didn't come in a huddle and, you know, act like the divas like they do these days. But they, when they came in a huddle, Mark and those guys just had a relationship where they can just look at each other and it's just like, okay, this is coming to you. You know what you got to do. Get open because I'm going to be throwing it. And sure enough, they went out there and did some great things. The offensive line was great. I tell you what, it was wonderful watching Jacoby in his day. You know, he was starting to go on his downhill, but he was still one of the best linemen around. Jim Lachey on the other side. Most people didn't talk much about him, but that was an absolute beast over there on the other side. And then with Bostic and Grimm and what they would do in the middle. And another guy who, I tell you what, who was one of the toughest players that probably didn't get anywhere near as much recognition, it was Riley McKenzie. He was one of the toughest linemen out there. I love watching him play. He can play any position across that offensive line. He was just outright good. But that team that we had with, you know, whether you want to talk about the Pirates or whatnot, it was not just them. It was the whole unit that, you know, the way that it operated and the way that they played and the way that they prepared. Practices were, you know, sometimes were just like so competitive. Joe had this, you know, sometimes just like, you know, listen, guys, let's not get burned out for the game, whatnot. Guys were just that competitive within that offense.
Well, then 1991 came, and I believe that was the season where you scored every time you touched the ball, if I remember. It seemed like it.
It seemed like it, didn't it? Yeah. Like it.
The game I really remember was this, though, okay? I'm a huge Bengals fan. I was only like 21, 22. You know, I didn't have a lot of money, so I only went to one game a year. And I went to the game where the Redskins played the Bengals, and you scored 3 touchdowns and beat us by a touchdown. Why did you do that to me?
Well, it was called They Couldn't Stop Us, that's all. They had to get something else going. But, no, that was, you know, coming up there to in that system, my thing was, and I think I had an ability in a short yard situations a lot of times. It's kind of where I had gotten hurt. And then Joe was like, okay, when you come back, let's, you know, I know that what you can do in close quarters. I had, for whatever reason, you say I'm a big back, but I had the ability, basically from being a fullback, to read a lot of plays on the inside very, very quickly. And I think that's what helped me so much in scoring a lot of touchdowns. We went into those short yardage situations. That was my forte. That was my deal.
Well, and during your career, probably no bigger moment for you than Super Bowl 26. And you get Super Bowl 26 against the Buffalo Bills, score 2 touchdowns, I believe, in your last game. What was it like to not only play in a Super Bowl, but to have a very significant impact on the outcome and go and walk away a champion?
That's what you play for. This is the opportunity that you get. When you finally get that opportunity to play in that type of game, you want to factor. You want to be a guy that says, you know, that I wasn't just on the sideline holding a clipboard or something. You know, that going to that game and it was I almost had the opportunity to start in that game because of I was basically healthy at the time I had. But you know, during the season things had been going well. And we didn't change up anything. You know, we left Ernest as being kind of the guy who was starting the game and whatnot, but even though you want to say, well, neither one of us were starters, we were both of the offensive backs that they had, they were going with. But I really felt that game, had I had the opportunity to start that game, I was so prepared for it. I know in my mind I would have set a rushing record in that game against that Buffalo Bills defense. We were that prepared. We were that confident about it. And, you know, going into that game, like I said, you want to factor in. You don't want to be the guy just to say, oh, well, I was there. So giving given that opportunity to do so. I missed scoring a third touchdown after I would have had three touchdowns, but I got stopped on one play. But we were just destined that year. We had everything going our way. We had lost out the year before in San Francisco, and it was one of those things we wanted to kind of complete it. We wanted to make sure that we finished it the way that we needed to. Bobby Bethard was just gone out of there. Charlie Cassidy had taken over. It was still a Bobby Bethard, Joe Gibbs team at the time, and we wanted to make sure that we finished the job.
So what made you decide that was going to be your final year?
It was just, you know, it came down to a lot of different obstacles and stuff. You know, the changing of the guard, of course, with Bobby Bethard, and Joe Gibbs was just getting into his race cars and all that. I don't think that as much attention was, they were kind of almost breaking the team up a little bit. I didn't want to be that guy just, you know, kind of hanging on and whatnot. And yeah, just called it. It was time for me to go. Some other reasons were there too, and I don't want to get into those right now, but you know, that was just the time. It seemed like, you know, walk away at the you know, being a winner, being a Super Bowl champion.
What was like your biggest rivalry, or maybe a biggest one-on-one matchup that you remember, either as a Falcon or as a Redskin, that you had to deal with?
From a player standpoint.
An opponent.
Oh gosh, almighty! There were a few of those. I tell you what, one team it was a heated game always, was when we played against the Saints, and those Saints linebackers that they had with Ricky Jackson, Von Johnson, Pat Swilling, and Sam Mills. They had, to me, arguably one of the best linebacker groups in the league at the time. And we always had some pretty heated rivalries in those games. And then, of course, San Francisco with Bill Walsh teams and the Ronnie Lott and all that sort of stuff. Ronnie, for all of what he, you know, was in the league or whatnot, he will, you know, actually flat out knock you out if you get an opportunity. But I just have to tell you, you'd have to ask him, you know, that we had some pretty good battles. we had some very, very good battles. But those two guys, I mean, those two teams probably were the most. And then, of course, when I got over to Washington, Philadelphia. Philadelphia was arguably one of the toughest defenses, of course, with Reggie White and all them, all those guys there, Seth Joyner. They had some pretty doggone good players at that time, too. But everybody always talks about that Chicago Bears defense in 85. One of the games that I'll remember probably forever because it was cold as heck up in Chicago. And David Archer, our quarterback, I think he almost came out with negative yards passing. I was the only guy that, and I think it checked the records. I'm not sure. He may have, but then I think I was the only guy that got 100 yards against him that year.
All right. So you retired from football. What have you been doing since then?
A bunch of different things, guys. I think when I say I'm retired, I retired to only get back into something else. I worked with kids. I've done radio. I've done my own radio show. I've worked with the Falcons. I've worked with with the CBS guys down there. And right now, I'm just kind of trying to enjoy life. I started what I call the Drill Rigs Network, and I try to help fathers and sons kind of bridge the gap between, you know, relationships and doing it in a little bit different manner, trying to do it from a more of a religious perspective, and trying to help guys who may have been in that same position that I was in, where they didn't have a father or they have a strange relationship with them, and try to counsel them back to get together, try to work them out. Fathers find different job avenues if they've had issues with child support or something like that. Try to help them to do some things to be in the lives of their sons, because I think that's where the enemy is attacking the society so much, is with the sons. The sons are not coming up to be men. They're being, you know, and it's, I know that they have mothers. Most of the time the fathers are not there, but it's very difficult for a woman to raise a man. So to help them to get some of the things that I think that we all need to have. It starts with bridging that gap between the fathers and those sons, and getting them to have a dialogue, have some communication, and be taught how to go from being a boy to going through the different stages in between, what we call the warrior stages and all that, and then going to be on to be the father that they need to be.
Is there any particular organization that we can let our listeners know that you're involved with on this?
Not one in particular. I'm a more of a resource, so it's like I'm not claiming to one in particular. Just what I'm doing is like I said, more of a resource. When they go on my webpage, and that's at drillrigsnetwork.com, you can find some of the, you'll be able to find some of the different avenues. I've kind of restructured the website here now for going into the rest of this year, so there'll be some things on there that is not on there right now, but if you go on there, you can look and see a little bit more about what I'm about here in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
That's very admirable. That's tremendous. One other question about today's game. What's your opinion of present-day NFL running backs? Are there any particular guys that you like to watch? And what's your opinion of the crop as a whole?
Ooh, that I get to, the hair stands up on the back of my neck most of the time. I watch some of these guys because it's so different now. These guys are. They got a specialty guy for this, a specialty guy for that. A guy goes out in a passing situation, guy goes out on a goal line or something. I think that the days of when we played, with Walter, with Eric Dickerson, with, my Barry Sanders, with Roger Craig. I can go on and on with the guys that played during our era that we did everything. It wasn't they got very few guys now who are literally going to take on that task of being a complete running back. And I think that from a running back standpoint, there are not very many complete running backs in the league. Everybody wants to be a runner, but nobody wants to do the dirty work. Nobody wants to be in there sometimes in difficult situations. And then when they are, they don't perform. I think the players as a whole, there's too much, I think there's too much glamour in what they do now, and that when we played, we played hard. We played for the game. We played for the team's sake. We played for the fact that the guys who were on the field, we respected each other. We liked each other. We hung with each other. We did things with each other. These guys nowadays, I think their friendships are based on their contracts. And it's a little difficult, I think, for some of these guys to really have a relationship, where the team is very, very close, like we did in our day. So, it's just a different time. The game is played differently. With them trying to make the game more of a, you're thinking out there on the field instead of reacting on the field. I think that's kind of hurting. That's kind of hurt the quality of the game. Good football still being played. No, I'm not going to take that away from it. But I just think that all this stuff with this heads-up stuff and all that, they're trying to make everybody aware of all these different things that are going on the field. It kind of lends to some pretty crazy things that happen on the field out there. And it's just my opinion. They think that it's good. They say the game has been safer, and they feel all that way about how things are. That's great, and that's fine. It's a different age, different players. I still love the game of football, and I think it'll always be, to me, always king. This is the sport that I ended up loving, and I think America will still, and the world still loves NFL football.
Well, I think it still goes back to what you talked about a little bit earlier in the organizations you work with. Me and Matt talk about it all the time, and none of these sports are as good as they used to be, in our opinion. Maybe that's just because we're getting older. And everything was better. We thought everything was better when we were younger. But, when you see guys, before games that are on opposing teams going out and hanging out for 10 or 15 minutes when they're getting ready to play a game against them, that always kind of irritates me also.
Yeah. Well, we all kind of did that sort of too. My thing was go out there and 15 minutes before to intimidate. I mean, I had to get out.
Yeah.
I'd go out there and, you know, I'd run around the field or whatever, and I'd run through the other team's side or whatever. And it's about, hey, you know, we're getting ready to go battle, and I want you to know I'm going to be here too. You know, this is what you're going to contend with every day, or at least every play. So
society as a whole is not nearly as competitive as it used to be.
No. It's
well, that's for sure.
It's an entirely different age, guys.
Yeah. But, well, we're almost out of time. I really appreciate you calling in. It's been, an absolute honor to have you on. I mean, I know me and Matt were talking when we were talking about guys we want to have on. You were one of the names that a couple months ago popped into our heads because I think you were really underrated. I think you had 3 years where you had a little bit over 5,000 combined yards in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. It's been great having you on. I know Matt, I'm sure, agrees also.
Definitely. One of the best running backs I saw growing up, and it was truly an honor to have you on and get your perspective on things.
Well, guys, I really appreciate that, and we'll do it again maybe another time.
Oh, we'd love to have you back.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, Gerald.
Thanks, Gerald.
Hey, and remember, next Thursday night, we will have Christian Okoye on. The Nigerian Nightmare, or as Matt calls him, his favorite, Super Tecmo Bowl running back.
yes, I did play Super Tecmo Bowl. It was a blast, but watching him as a running back was also such a thrill. I mean, I was a teenager, and it just seemed like every time I'd see him, I didn't get to see a lot of Kansas City Chiefs games, but every once in a while I get to see him, and it was just like, who is this guy? This guy's gigantic. And it's just a lot of fun to watch.
Also, next Wednesday night, we have a special guest, George Visger. Played for the San Francisco 49ers. One of them that is in the concussion protocol, or one of the guys that sued the NFL over the concussion protocol and not taking care of the players. He was on Outside the Lines, ESPN, ran a story about him. Very interesting guy. I think that'll be a great show too, Matt. What do you think?
Yeah. Definitely. I remember when the story came out, fascinating story. I remember hearing the name, but I didn't know very much about him. And it brings quite a message. And the NFL needs to take care of their players. And so it'd be really great to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, the NFL definitely needs to take care of their players. They've made billions and billions of dollars, and there's no reason why anybody that, help make them that kind of money or build them into the empire that they are shouldn't be taken care of by them. But
right.
We will definitely, we'll get George's opinions and thoughts on that next Wednesday night. Next Tuesday night, Joe Rodriguez will be back with me for our boxing show. Working on finalizing a guest right now, but we'll have somebody on, and I'm sure it will be entertaining. And, once again, Matt will not listen to it because he refuses to listen to a show done by a Bengals and a Giants fan, or he doesn't like boxing. It's one of those two things. We're not sure
I got to sit in. I do enjoy boxing, not as much as you guys do, but I gladly listen.
You're a liar.
I
don't think you do. When's the last time you watched a fight?
Oh, boy. I haven't watched a recent
fight. That's what
I
thought.
I have seen some older fights, and I do appreciate the sport. It's just not
– What older fights
I'll admit
did
it's
you
not
see?
One of the –
I think you're
Marvin
lying.
Hagler,
I don't think you've ever
I didn't see the whole fights, but I've seen videos about Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard, and I respect all that. And I remember Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas and some of the things. I didn't watch a lot of boxing, but I do have a little bit of an appreciation for it.
All right. So remember, next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, The Grueling Truth will be back. Like I said, Wednesday night, former 49er George Visger. Thursday night, the Nigerian Nightmare, Christian Okoye. So be sure to tune in next week on The Grueling Truth, where legends speak.